This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Brussel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon, Dialogue Conspiracy. It's July the 8th in Carmel, California, Monday afternoon. And I'm sitting here with an assortment of articles of the week. The format of the show is to take the events of the week that pertain to past political assassinations and conspiracies and see how they line up. And I take a box of articles after each show and put them away. And as the news falls in, I select different topics. I have a list here. I want to briefly go into the weapon theft, the armory where the weapons were taken, a new movie called The Terminal Man, the new Supreme Court judgments against prisoners. I want to read some letters from prisoners. I want to talk about the report on the CIA and the Watergate. We'll go into that a little bit. There's a wrench in that the CIA was in a state of panic following the June 17th burglary in 1972. I laughed when I read that in Senator Baker's report, because that's the night that I started to do my research when those men got caught and came out with the article that it was a CIA conspiracy. I have an article here about a dope smuggling ring, $32 million worth of cocaine from Chile, and it came to a university professor, Marjorie Brown, Wisconsin, University of Agriculture, and a group of people down the line. If you wonder why you overthrow a country and take it by force and kill a good, decent man like Salvador Allende, there's one of your reasons to maintain this kind of operation and take it, the cocaine traffic, keep it moving in Latin America and Central America. And this ties into the Watergate gang, too, that's been covered up. They're closing shop this week. We'll talk a little bit about the Hearst kidnapping, not too much. It's not that news isn't coming in a way. I'm just kind of weary because I completed my article this week for The Realist. Completed it yesterday, as a matter of fact. It's 160 pages called Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? It started out to be 90 pages, and then Paul Krasner, the publisher of The Realist, said any length that I wanted, he would let me use my judgment, and then it was 120 pages. But I couldn't sign my name to the article unless I did it the way it should be told, in what I considered was an outline of the whole Hearst kidnapping, and it came to about 160 pages, which is really a book, and I'll be getting out in book form this summer. I'll go into the armory thing. I want to talk about the son of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Mr. Berger, his son lying to get a job with the General Accounting Office. I have all kinds of goodies here in how the government covers up these people and the shooting of Martin Luther King's mother. There's so much on the table. I bring it in and I say, what is the priority? Where do we go? See Arnold Smith, the old supporter of Richard Nixon, one of the first people, the Committee of 100 that put Richard Nixon into power, has been charged with misusing $170 million in funds from the United States National Bank, making false statements to the bank examiners, falsifying bank records, and so forth. That's one down, and a lot of them are down, and there's many more to go. Let's talk about the armory, because the article that I'm doing is about the what I call World War III. I compare the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst to the shooting of the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand, that they were only persons to be used as to precede an event. The World War I was planned long before that shooting took place of the Archduke. The countries were lining up, the armament people, the merchants of death, I call them, the people that make the arms. You don't see them, you don't know them. They sell guns to both sides. They'll sell them to Russia, they sell them to Germany. Just like in America, we have the merchants of death. They were giving delivering atomic bombs to the Middle East. We give them to the Jews, we give them to Israel, we give them to the Arabs, we give them to Iran. Anyone who wants to buy them, we make them, you buy them, kill each other, kill us, give or take a few. those people in business, and they send people like Mr. Henry Kissinger around the world to deliver promises of weapons contracts. Well, the Hearst case is what I call World War III. Coming down on the Third World is a war against people, and this signaled it, and that's the tone of the article. It begins with comparing it to the shooting of Archduke Ferdinand, and in lieu of that, there was this robbery in Los Angeles this week of the armory, July the 6th, huge theft of weapons from a state armory. Now, the article goes on, most of you read it in one of your newspapers across the country. The arsenal in Los Angeles just coincidentally happens to be like in the black part of town of Los Angeles, close to where the SLA shootout was, and the news wants to slant it that it could be for a combat unit like the SLA. They wouldn't dare say it was the SLA because there's no evidence. The excuse for the armory being robbed was that there's not enough money to guard it, that they just don't have enough guards. So the theft, there was 96 M16 rifles, 7 M60 machine guns, grenade launchers, automatic pistols, rounds of ammunition, machine gun bullets, all kinds of equipment for a nice little civil war. Well, the news media, the Associated Press, did cover the fact that these robberies at the armories supply weapons to the right wing and the left wing. In quotes, it says, the U.S. government is the largest supplier of illegal weapons through thefts resulting from lax security measures to revolutionary elements, both to the left and right, and criminal elements. And I know for a fact, because I've been studying for a few years, how much the police want a white racist police state, and the law enforcement are pushing this thing, and they are pushing narcotics and weapons into the ghetto, not new plans for schools or health or jobs, but pushing weapons, pushing narcotics, because for every piece of violence that comes from the left wing, the right can counter out with their bulletproof vests, their mace, the weapons, the camouflage disguises, their tat squads. So they let these little thefts take place because then they have an excuse to come back harder with more repression. And it's not a coincidence that a vault is unguarded in South Los Angeles and weapons of this massive amount are stolen. You see, one of the problems is as researchers like myself work, or Donald Freed in Los Angeles, or Lake Headley, and private investigators and people around the country, Sherman Skolnick has people working for him in Chicago, all around the country, as we detail where the police are supplying the weapons to the blacks and encouraging them in a radical philosophy, books on Mao and so forth, as hoping to get a response, as we pinpoint who's handing the weapons to them, just like you pinpoint who's handing the drugs, then they can't dish them out like they've been doing for so long. The Los Angeles Police Department supplying weapons to one group to kill off the other group. I keep referring to them because that's the city and the police agency I know the best, because my state is California. Robert Kennedy's murder was down in Los Angeles. That's the agency that covered it up. So I've been watching that agency and our attorney general, you know, for a long time. But so I talk about our own state. I'm sure this is happening around the country. There's parallels around the country when I pick up the news. But the picking up of the army, of leaving the doors open and taking it, is that the police department can't say, well, here, Donald DeFries, take this gun and go rob a bank. He turned in a cache of 200 guns to the LAPD as an informer when he was working for them. He turned in his roommate, as a matter of fact, and all the guns were serial. They had serial numbers and so forth. And 2 years later, Donald DeFries is robbing a bank and shooting a guard, and he has one of the guns that the police took from a cache a few years earlier. So that is a fact, that the Los Angeles Police Department rearms a man to commit an act of violence, and then they use him later and manipulate him. But you see, they have been supplying weapons. So to say they're stolen is a nice espionage way of allowing the weapons to get into hands, and then the counteraction comes down later. The movie I want to talk about, because it's important with the prison thing, decision of the Supreme Court, and it's a movie that you should try to see, you people that can get out to a movie. It's opening up, it's in New York City, and it's in San Francisco, and it'll be all around the country. It's called The Terminal Man. George Segal is in the movie, and Joan Hackett, The Terminal Man. And what is this movie about? The movie is about a man who invented the land camera. Thomas R. is his medical name. He's been written up in many medical accounts. Dr. Bragan, particularly from out of Washington, Dr. Peter Bragan, has been exposing what happened to Thomas R. Thomas R.'s real name is Leonard Kille, K-I-L-L-E, and I've talked about him on shows before, and they made a story for him. Michael Crichton wrote a novel called The Terminal Man, which is Thomas R. It is an actual story about this particular person. And this man invented the land camera. The land camera is the Polaroid camera. He was a brilliant inventor. He lived in Massachusetts, and he had used his talent to invent this particular camera. What happened was that he was put into a hospital, allegedly for being violent, which he never was until the day he realized that they were going to put electrodes in his brain. This is the true story. The movie's on his life. The book Terminal Man is his life. I'm going to tell you about Thomas R. That's the medical name, and his real name, Leonard Kille, only surfaced recently because the family has a $2 million lawsuit. His mother lives in Long Beach, and they've placed a $2 million lawsuit against the doctors. Frank H. Ervin, E-R-V-I-N, was one of the doctors, and Dr. Vernon Mark from Boston City Hospital were two of the doctors that put the electrodes in his brain. Now, Dr. Ervin is from UCLA. That's the school that wants to implant electrodes into the brains of prisoners and do experiments at the Nike bases out in California, secret bases. Frank Ervin used to work in back east at Boston, at the hospital back in Boston, Boston City Hospital, with Dr. Mark and Dr. Sweet. There was a team of three of them. And Dr. Ervin and Dr. Mark wrote a book called Violence and the Brain. And they used four examples of people that they had treated medically with electrodes. And one of them was this Leonard Kille, and they've placed this suit. Now, the point about this particular man who was a brilliant scientist, and I'll run down briefly a little bit about his life. He was an engineer. He was brilliant. He, as I say, invented the land camera, which is used by the space agencies and the government for their space trips. He was referred to Massachusetts General in 1966 for some EEG tests because he had epilepsy, and he wanted some kind of test to see if there was something to do about the epilepsy. It was diagnosed as psychomotor epilepsy, and the hospital chart showed no instance of uncontrollable rage of any kind. He had no problems except that he had a wife, and he threw some cans at her once. He didn't knife her or shoot her. He threw some cans in the kitchen. He missed her, but some beer cans kind of thing, and he had a fight with her. And she went to these two doctors, and I bring up the point because the wife in espionage is very important. Marina Oswald directed Lee Harvey Oswald in a similar matter till his death in Dallas. She was the manipulative agent behind Lee Harvey Oswald. Last week I mentioned the woman that took Herbert Mullen in San Francisco to an army hospital in Hawaii where he went through psychological changes. Well, this particular woman took her husband, told him to go see these doctors at Massachusetts General who were receiving federal money for experimentations of this kind, and he was put in the hospital, and he wasn't restrained, and he wasn't considered dangerous, and he went for a neurological diagnosis. Now, his wife threatened that she would leave him if he didn't have this operation that would cure the epilepsy, and he accused her of not being faithful to them. There was another man living at the house with them, and she said he's paranoid. That the wife said, "I'm not having an affair with the other man. It's his mental problem." And she insisted that he go to the hospital. And when he was in the hospital, he wrote to his mother in Long Beach and said in a letter, "My operation is like science fiction." Well, what they did, she threatened to divorce him if he didn't have this surgery. And for some unknown reason, whether under medication or what, he did say, "Okay, you can relieve the epilepsy." So they proceeded to put four strands of electrodes into his head. Each one was the length of a brain. It was a small wire that was put in his brain, and there were two on each side, and each strand had 20 or more smaller electrodes, and they stimulated lesions in his brain, and he was forced to give consent. He was under stimulation at the time that they implanted the electrodes, and so that he became violent when he found out what they were doing. and he protested vigorously against these destructive lesions in the amygdala, it's called, and they were carried out anyway. He had surgery October 21st, 1966. The electrodes were left in till August the 1st, 67, 7 months after the implantations. Now, he went to the West Coast in California, the Veterans Hospital, and he was getting very sick. The electrodes were there, and he was unable to work. He couldn't do anything. He was in the VA hospital. And then he was writing things on the wall about death or violence or suicide, and he seemed to have a violence which never was there before the electrodes were in. So the VA hospital wrote to Massachusetts General. So instead of Dr. Mark and Irvin and Sweet saying, yes, we did A, B, C, and D, this man had this, it indicated that, this was our surgery, they didn't tell him that he had electrodes in his brain, that Leonard Keel had them, and that they'd created lesions in his brain by microwave, by placing these electrodes in his brain. And what they were trying to do, they wanted to control him and his moods and actions, and they told him they were going to turn him up or down, and they could control his behavior and what he did. So the VA writes for the medical record, and they don't tell him what they've done to him back in California. In October 68, the VA declared Leonard Keel totally disabled for the first time in his life, and he still is, and that's why the lawsuit against these doctors. In 1970, the book came out, Violence in the Brain, and they said that Thomas R. passed 4 years without a violent rage. Well, in 68, he was admitted to the hospital. He was fighting with a policeman, and his violence came out against himself and the people around him at the VA and later at home, and he's reduced to a vegetable. Now, why would a hospital like this in Boston, Massachusetts, why would they take a scientist's brain and tamper with that brain? He's an intelligent man. How did they get away with it? And I bring up the point because so much of this experimentation is happening in our prisons all around the country, but particularly the same people that did that to him in Boston are out here in California and wanting to step up their experiments at Vacaville and Soledad and so forth. How can you take there's a two-pronged question. How can you take a person who's intelligent and get him into a condition to reduce him to an animal, a zombie with electrodes, who has this brilliant mind? And the other question is, how do you protect a prisoner who is not sophisticated, who has no lawyer, whose family has abandoned him, and get him in the same position to experiment to become a zombie? And then another question is, why? Why? Well, a lot of the men doing brain surgery want to work with people who are intelligent. I have copies of reports, congressional records, and so forth, where the doctors have said they just don't want ordinary intelligence. They want above intelligence so that they can play around with the reasoning ability, with the creative ability, and they want to experiment on certain people with brains. So given the right climate or a mild excuse like the epilepsy and a woman that can entrap you, they can have your brain. It's up for grabs. Now, was the woman placed there? Was this his wife? Was she an espionage agent delivering a brain to the hospital? You have to ask yourself what reason. And one of the subjects that I think might be of interest is, I have a copy here, 89th Congress. Now, this is in 1966, and all this was happening to him. He went into Massachusetts General, Leonard Keel, in 1966, but at the Department of Defense Appropriations in 1966, there was a hearing before the subcommittee, the Committee on Appropriations, the House of Representatives, 89th Congress, the first session. And I think this will be interesting because this is what I got from the government printing office. A person who listens to my radio shows and who knows I'm interested in this has congressional records and was able to get this from her files. This is the testimony of a Mr. Meisner testifying before the House Appropriations Committee. And he was talking about the Miami section of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers in July 63 and reports that they had, bringing up to date to 66. And it's interesting, they were talking about laser beams and flash bulbs and organic lasers and revolvers and so forth. It was a scientific subject that was being brought up at the hearings. And then, this is part of the hearings, I'll read you. It says, one of the big problems, one of the big business fears, independent inventors, as the independents very frequently upset the entrenched apple carts with the industry shaking explosive new ideas over which they have no control. In other words, the major industries get very upset by a small inventor coming up with something that puts the older system out of business. They have no control. They use the example, Edison's electric lamp was one such for the gas illuminating industry. It affected the gas company. So was Bell's telephone for the telegraph company. And now the land camera is shaking the timbers of the photographic industry with the new camera. Now, this is like what Leonard Cayley invented would put out, say, the Kodak, only when he was dead, you know, the Kodak and the land. I'm sure that they're overlapping now in some. I don't know if the exclusive is still on the land camera. I don't know how the who gained or lost by this manipulation of this individual, but they use the example that Edison shook up the gas company by inventing electricity and the Bell telephone for the telegraph companies, and now the land camera is shaking the very tumults of the photographic industry with his new camera, and they don't use the name of the inventor here at the hearing, with his new camera in super ultra-fast film and the latest in color, and entrenched, the industry wants no world-shaking inventions. These often make obsolete what they know, what facilities they have, and what products. And it can be easily digested in the improvements they make. The congressional record said that people can make improvements what they have, but they don't want changes. They want peace and not great progress. This is in 1966. Their preachments to the country, notwithstanding, they constantly belittle the independents. They call them garage inventors, and they exploit their great fancy laboratories that produce real innovations. Now, I think that's interesting that it was brought up the year that this particular man begins to be examined in 66 and begins to lose his mind and can't use his invention, which was the land camera. Congress has a hearing where a man is telling how it is against the interests of set industries to have new inventions that shake them to the foundations. So looking at that and looking what happened to this man to being reduced to a vegetable, is it a coincidence that so many women are accompanying men to a position where they're either murdered or experimented on? Because I could do a whole show, I have files on the use of women to entrap men into this position, and is there a relationship to what happened to that man? He became the subject of the book called The Terminal Man, and many of you have seen the paperback. It is a real man. It is a man that scared the photographic industry to its foundations, but when he was no longer effective, the land camera became the camera of the space agencies. They took it up. They photographed everything with it, and it became an industry of its own. I don't know who inherited it when he no longer could function, but the man was reduced to a vegetable after he invented it. But the camera is used by all of you who have land cameras, enjoy them. And sometimes we don't appreciate the pain that an inventor goes through. And I have a friend that I met through these radio shows whose husband is a brilliant inventor. And you have no idea what hassle. His life is in danger all the time. He lives in the Santa Cruz area. He's entrapped and almost entrapped in a situation like this same terminal man. He has been hospitalized. His life has been jeopardized, and he could go into a hospital on a situation like this. It's a life and death, day-to-day existence, because he's one of California's most brilliant inventors. He's made contributions to everyone in this country and in the world. So he lives on a very precarious back-and-forth existence, never knowing who your friend or enemy is. So that movie, I bring it up and I emphasize it because it's a true story. It isn't something out of somebody's imagination. The Supreme Court came down with some more blows this last week against prisoners' rights. The more I get into political assassinations and into my work in depth, I always end up back. I start with the prisons, I end back with the prisons. They're so terribly important to a police state. I started investigating who killed John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and all these other murders that I'm doing in the book, Murderville USA. And then I got into the prison system seriously about 2 years ago when I went to the trial of Hugo Pinnell and Salinas. And ever since then, I have been asking myself, what is coming down? Who is behind it? What are the links? And it's perfectly reasonable that you have to block off the prisons from people going inside and seeing what's going on, isolate your prisoner if, in fact, you are going into a police state. If you're going to murder these political leaders and you want control, one of the most important controls is your prison. And before the Supreme Court, I'm going to read you an editorial from the Washington Post this week, because it quotes Chief Justice Warren Burger spoke last year on the reform of American prison systems and how we ignore the prisoners. And this is what he said in quotes: "We continue to brush under the rug the problems of those who are found guilty and subject to sentence. In a very immature way, we want to remove the problem from public consciousness. It is a melancholy truth that has taken a tragic prison outbreak of the past 3 years to focus attention on the problem." Now, after Warren Burger made that decision, the Supreme Court voted this last week 5-4 that prison regulations barring interviews between reporters and inmates did not violate the constitutional guarantee of free speech and free press. Warren Burger was against the prisoners having the right to have people in to interview them so that they can tell their story. And the Washington Post says, "How else are we going to know it if we can't get in and see these people? They're isolated from us, and we're isolated from them." There was a lawsuit against the California prison system, and a Washington Post reporter stating that the journalist has the right to interview inmates if they have a specific story to tell. And the Supreme Court said, no, that you don't have the right. Their reasoning was the prisoners were not cut off from the public because they could write letters to reporters if they so choose. And it held that the rights of the prison administration had to be balanced against the right of the prisoner and the press. Well, I'm going to take this opportunity. The Supreme Court said that the prisoner has the right to write to a reporter, and he in turn can tell the news. So what I think I should do every week on KLRB is read maybe one letter from a prisoner each week. I get many each week. My mail is piled up, backlogged, because of the article I finished, but I'll be getting to it. But I thought maybe today I'd read you a letter from a prisoner from Soledad, and then you get a sample, one that was at Tracy, and you get a sample of the mail coming from prisoners, because if the reporters can't get in there, I might as well take their letters and read them on the air, because that's what the Chief Justice said we should do, right? Here's a letter from, I won't give the names, one I said I was at Tracy. This is a California prison. I was picked up one night and placed in the hole, which is solitary confinement, as against the general prison population. I was placed with charges ranging from murder to possession of prison-made weapons. This was October 21st, 1973, and all the charges were referred to the district attorney in San Joaquin County. Every charge was dropped there. The district attorney refused to prosecute the case. There was no evidence to back the charges, so they took him back to the prison community, and he thought he would serve his time for whatever charge he was in because this other thing was dropped. But it didn't work out that way. He goes back to the prison community, and the Department of Corrections has their own little tribunal inside the walls, and they find him guilty on all charges, the murder and the possession of the weapons. They said I would do a long-term violation, and they put this in the record, and they put pictures of the body and the weapon. And they said, "I am guilty, and I know nothing about these charges. I was placed in the hole and charged later with all of them. I've been investigated by investigators from the streets, and there is nothing to the charges and no evidence to back them up. I want to hire a lawyer. I've never been in any kind of trouble like this before. Can you give me advice?" Now, you know, this goes into the article I'm doing on DeFreeze and the prison system. Here's one more letter I'll read today, and I'll do two next week, and we'll do two every week, because Warren Burger has said we should. If I'm in the media, I should use the media. If I'm getting letters, read them to you. This is the California Department of Corrections. This is a man from one of the California prisons, wrote to me, dated May the 5th, 14th. "The California Department of Corrections has been trying to use me for its own private assassination program, destined to eliminate aware elements inside the prison. First in Vacaville at the Northern Reception Center. Some 6 months ago, I was approached by Tony Paletto, head of security and investigation, and he offered to have me sent to Chino Prison and released soon, in the neighborhood of 6 months, if I would book, which means to kill, someone, along with a veiled promise of similar jobs once I got on the streets, without having to worry about prosecution. You see what that implies, that the court has to be going along. If he's not going to be prosecuted, the police have to be told by prison people, don't get him, he's okay. In other words, he's going to kill on the outside. And this is the problem. The prison wants to keep certain men inside. And if they get parole and they've served their time, they hire someone to kill them on the outside. And that's it. So you're not safe as long as these people are running it. And I'm naming the names of the people. Like in the article I have coming out, I'm naming the names of people that offer prisoners to kill inside and outside, because I think it's time we give them names, just like my article names. The article named Patrick Gray and John Mitchell and Richard Nixon, and I'm naming prison officials. Tony Pulido, head of security of investigations, offered a man to be out in 6 months if he would kill somebody, and on the streets he would kill. At that time, I had an overwhelming urge to accept, which I can't explain, but I refused. I wanted nothing to do with the California Department of Corrections. So he came apart at the seams and threatened to have me killed in one way or another or see me in prison the rest of my life. In December, I was put in the hole in segregation with an assault charge. That is a mystery to me, and it still is. In the next couple of months, I was given a phony write-up and again threatened by Pulido, and I was transferred to Soledad. And at 2 in the morning, a guard approached my cell and told me he had someone he wanted me to kill. He brought up my past refusal to do so in Vacaville, and he said that I was going to do my maximum sentence in long-term lockup. He went on to say he wasn't asking now, but he was telling me either I commit a murder that I didn't want to do, or I'd be found hung in my cell like John Carp, 1972. You can check this out, you investigators who are listening to these shows and following up. I'm getting letters or doing research on these things. K-A-R-P, 1972, hung in his cell. It may have been marked as suicide. It evidently was a murder. If I agreed to the same deal that I could get out that I was offered in Vacaville. This was on the guy that was causing problems for the CDC, and they wanted him out of the way. I saw the California Department of Corrections for it was, for all its corruptions, and I turned them down. For once, my conscience is clear, and I don't regret writing this. I want to have a decent break and be able to expose these corrupt dogs. Now, if any prisoners want to write to KLRB, Box 3904, or write to their families, or if they feel their life is in danger, write to their lawyers and have their lawyers give me their address. And we'll read two letters like that every week on the show and write them up and send them off to the proper authorities. I have hundreds of those, and I think as long as the Supreme Court says the media should share them, then I think we should share them. The Supreme Court has come back. They had three decisions against prisoners this last week, which is not surprising considering the Nixon report. They said the court declared that newsmen have no constitutional right to demand interviews. The cold-blooded measures of this presidential administration just keep men behind bars, and they can't tell the truth, and we have to end that. One of my favorite prisoners up in San Francisco, Yuko Pinnell, was testifying at that trial. You know, the San Quentin Six are accusing the prison system of all kinds of torture in the last three-year period of time. They're kept like animals, fed food with feces. We ran them down last week, a few of the charges. And Hugo Pinnell was on the stand last week telling how he was offered to be out. He would be out of prison today if he had said that George Jackson murdered some men at Soledad Prison. And Hugo Pinnell said to Sergeant Maddox, this was out in Soledad, he said, if that's the way I'm going to get out of prison, I'll spend the rest of my life here. And he turned down the offer also. There's a lot of heroic, beautiful people who have turned down these offers, and there's a lot of men alive who owe their life to this kind of courage. So I think we should be aware of how many people are not accepting the offers of the prison system, but the important thing is to get the men that are making these offers out of the jobs and fired and removed. Well, Gerald Ford was in Dallas. It's been 10 years since the Kennedy assassination. He said there was allegedly a sniper scare at his car. I have so many memories of the Warren Report and the research I've done for 10 years that while this little news account may not mean much to you, I think there's some ironic kind of justice in it. The Vice President of the United States was driving down a street in Dallas going to the Trademark, the same place that John Kennedy was headed,
and allegedly heat expansion broke a window in his car. There were three versions of what happened to the glass plate inside of the car of Vice President Gerald Ford, but I'm going to give you my fourth version. First, they said it was a heat expansion, and the Secret Service said it was a new car. They'd never used it. And then the Department of Public Safety said, no, that's not a new car. We've used it since February the 1st, and it has 255 miles on it. Then the next explanation was that there was a bullet. The first car that came out, the man driving the car, the lead car ahead of Gerald Ford, called in and said, we've been hit by a bullet. And when they arrived at a safe place, they didn't find a bullet, so they ruled out the bullet theory. There was no bullet. They couldn't find a bullet. Then they had a large hole in the glass, and they thought a rock had gone through the window. Well, it would certainly be as easy to find a rock as a bullet, and they couldn't find a rock. So you're left with, how did the glass break of this car that made it look as if Gerald Ford were going through the same kind of a trip that John Kennedy did, but he hardly did because he left and went home alive. Well, about 2 years ago, I was bringing a bowl of flowers from the kitchen into the family room, and the piano tuner was there. And I'd always heard these stories about certain tunes breaking. You hear a certain note and you break glass. I'd heard it, but I'd never experienced it. And I was walking through the room, and he hit a certain note on the piano, and this vase I had broke open, and the water spilled all over and just crashed to the floor. And he hit a note, and the glass broke. So I believe that what Gerald Ford was going through, you see this psychic from Israel who bends keys, who bends metals, and a lot of people are showing this psychic phenomena, how you can break material substance with thought waves. So what I think happened was that Gerald Ford's brain was so filled with guilt about the John Kennedy assassination that his brains broke the glass. They can't find the bullet or the rock, and we know that the mind moves matter, so that's my version for whatever it's worth. A little bit about the Harris escapade down in Los Angeles. The FBI has reduced the amount of forces that are watching Patty Hearst. I do a lot of research, and I have files that go back 10 years, and they're not alphabetized or computerized in any way except my own particular filing system. And one of my very close friends called me this week to remind me, she had a newspaper from 71 that said that Charles Bates, the FBI director of the San Francisco investigation of the Hearst kidnapping or the Zebra case, Charles Bates came from Washington, D.C., where he'd been there 1 year in the Justice Department. Before that, he was in Chicago, Illinois, during that time period when Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were murdered, the Black Panthers. And that explains so much about the parallels between the Hearst case and the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. The FBI orders to kill all Black leaders, the use of infiltration, a man by the name O'Neill, an informer that worked for the FBI, told the police department where Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were sleeping, what beds, and had a layout of the plan. And he also put something into their foods that made them asleep so they didn't hear the entry of the police when they came storming in. And in Los Angeles, when the SLA were murdered and Donald DeFries, there were Black agents of the FBI and police that led them to their death trap that I just finished writing up. And all we know is that one woman, Mrs. Johnson, came out of there. She said she was in a drug sleep, and she said Camilla Hall was walking around like a zombie. But outside of that, we had no description of the state of mind of these people. And I've written a lot about that. But it would explain their total lack of anxiety, because they were dependent upon all food and all liquor and all grass that was bought into the house. They were entrapped inside a bungalow with no transportation to get out and no supplies. And so whoever brought them the food, whether it was from Sam's Delicatessen at the corner or whatever, they were totally dependent upon somebody bringing everything they ate or drank. And also when the SWAT team came and murdered them, the LA Police Department using the Marine trained SWAT team, they were fired up with a story that the SLA had murdered an officer by the name of Edwards a few days earlier, and so they killed with this big vengeance. And when the police came and killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, they were told that the Black Panthers had killed a law enforcement man a few days earlier. There's many parallels between the SLA operation and the killing of Black Panthers, particularly in the Chicago area. So I find it interesting just to realize this week, learn that Charles Bates, who isolated Randolph Hearst, had dinner with him every night, isolated him, cut him off from any evidence that this was a major conspiracy of another kind, was in charge of the Chicago operation. Well, the newspaper said this week there was an article that Russell, these are the two men charged with the murder of Dr. Marcus Foster, Russell Little and Joseph Romero, have keys that the prosecution is using to show that they were involved in the murder of Dr. Marcus Foster. They had an apartment on 7th Street in Oakland, just a block, well, it's less than a mile from where Dr. Marcus Foster was killed and Dr. Robert Blackburn was shot. And these two men had a key to this apartment on 7th Street, which they used as a safe house. It was a place where they ran from the shooting, and the police didn't find them there. I've been doing a lot of writing about that apartment. I finished writing about it. And one of the pieces of evidence of the prosecution is that these men had the key to the apartment. But what the news media doesn't tell you, and what I've been busy in the article telling and give you glimpses of it, was that the apartment, allegedly Russell and Little rented it as of October the 1st in 1973. But Emily Harris and William Harris, the two agents from the Midwest that I've talked about that have Patricia Hearst now, or allegedly have her, they used that address in September 1973. They've got driver's license. Willie Wolf, Emily Harris, and William Harris got a driver's license using the address 1621 7th Avenue, which was the getaway house for the Marcus Fosters. So they provided, they had to be the people that supplied the apartment house for the other men that are being charged for using it as a getaway. Maybe they used it as a getaway. But how is it two men are charged, only two, with the murder of Dr. Marcus Foster, and the people that provided that safe house, knowing it's a safe house because they have their own lush apartment not too far away in Oakland, the Harrises, why did they use an alias and get this house in September? They knew that date as of September when they got a driver's license, and Romero and Little weren't going to use it until October. So the Harrises lead the way. The espionage agents get the locations, get the safe houses for James Earl Ray, Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan. They get the rent. They provide the building. They know the managers don't see anything or hear anything. In fact, the manager of this building was a security guard. They don't see when somebody leaves. They don't see him check in. And then they entrap their patsies to use it for an operation. But the Harrises had used that apartment for an address previously to when Romero and Little used it. Now, a quotation of San Francisco FBI Director Bates again, June the 10th, he was telling the Harrises to come forward now that they would be taken peacefully. He has an offer. He said it's better if Ms. Hearst is taken without violence, and the Harrises are less militant than their six SLA comrades. So far, Bates said the Harrises were not overtly involved in any of these incidences. You see, they did not go at the scene of the shooting of Dr. Foster, but isn't it a conspiracy to be a part of the whole thing? They sent out communiques bragging that they killed him, saying that they were part of an army, but now Mr. Bates is offering them immunity, as much as immunity, and making a deal because they are the agents that will be protected, and he's going to see that his top agents don't get too tough a time. Well, the week was filled with all kinds of news about the CIA and the Watergate. The Watergate committee is closing. We should say something in the last 3 minutes. The Senate Select Committee is closing House this week. They're closing July the 11th, 1974, 2 years after the first article I wrote was finished, July the 11th in 72. They're closing shop. And Senator Sam Ervin, who is just a fool for closing up, made an opening statement when the Senate Select Committee began to investigate the Watergate in May 1773. And I put the whole thing in full in my second Realist article last year because I knew they'd never live up to it. And I thought for historic purposes, for whatever it's worth, the world may be full of a lot of fools, but it's filled with a lot of smart people, too. I come into this station today and there were at least 20 or more letters from everywhere, from Boston and from Sacramento and Ohio, Massachusetts, cities in California and across the country. People are catching on and they want these articles. And I did put in my article purposely what they were doing, the opening statement, because they never intended to do it. And I knew they didn't intend to do it. And you have to see what the government says they're doing as against what they're doing. because what Sam Ervin said was what they were seeking was to steal not the jewels, money, or property of American citizens, but something more valuable, their free election. The Senate committee must probe into the assertions that the very system is subverted. And he goes on to say, the purpose of this committee is to provide a full and open testimony so the nation can proceed against and towards the healing of wounds. The nation and history itself are watching us. We cannot fail this mission. And he lists, we're going into every accusation at every level. He says we won't leave any stone unturned, like the Warren Commission. Well, this week, Sam Ervin announced that the committee expires as of July the 11th. And this is what Sam Ervin says. In theory, the Watergate committee job was to recommend legislation to prevent a recurrence of the Watergate. Now, that wasn't what it was about. The Watergate Committee's job wasn't to stop a recurrence. It was to find out who did what to the 1972 elections. So they pervert around. They said the most important thing, Sam Ervin said, is that the American people get the truth than that a few people go to trial. Now, how are you going to get the truth without a trial? So he said from the beginning, we wanted to show the system could work. So they closed shop this week, January the 11th. But I assure you that as long as a few people with courage keep asking questions and looking for answers, we'll get the truth no matter what those fools do. They are a bunch of fools, and we will find the truth because they haven't even touched the surface. My time is up. Have a good week. It's a hot summer here in Carmel. I hope you're cooling off around the country, and we'll see you next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.